Good evening, everyone. My name is David Elwood, and I'm the dean here at the Harvey Kennedy School. Welcome to the John F. Kennedy Jr. Forum. This is a very special night because this is the night the David Ninepies and the Teddy White lecture are provided, and it's a very exciting time to us all. I'm also very pleased that Carol Shorenstein-Hayes is here with us. Carol, are you here? There you are. Thank you. Carol, as many of you will know, is a remarkable producer of and champion of Broadway plays and many other remarkable features on both coasts. And so it's especially terrific that you could be here representing the Shorenstein family. Walter Shorenstein very desperately wanted to be here with us tonight, but unfortunately had a fall recently and is recovering well, but he was not able to join us. So thank you, Carol, for being here with us. I'm supposed to keep this brief because the next speaker is Alex Jones, and he gives phenomenal introductions. Indeed, I try and not have him give very many because he always makes me feel bad about my introductions. So I'm trying to set you up a little bit here, Alex. But he is the Lawrence Lombard Lecturer in the Press and Public Policy, and he's the director of the Jones Shorenstein Center on Press, Politics, and Public Policy. As many of you will know, he covered the press for the New York Times from 1983 to 92, and he was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 1987. And he co-authored, along with Susan Tift, who's also with us here tonight, a wonderful book on the New York Times called The Patriarch, The Rise and Fall of the Bingham Dynasty. In 1992, he left the Times to work on The Trust, the powerful family behind the New York Times. I misquoted these here. Which was a finalist in the Book Critics Circle Award. He's been a Nieman Fellow, he's been all around. But the reason he's here is because of his extraordinary leadership at the Shorenstein Center. He has helped us in the most difficult set of problems that I think we face in the media today of thinking about what's happening and how we can take ourselves to a much better place for the future as these various titanic institutions are under great pressure. So with no further ado, to introduce our two spectacular recipients and lecturer tonight, Alex Jones.
Thank you. Thank you very much, David. As David said, each year this night is a very happy and special one of celebration for the Shorenstein Center. As some of you already know, the Shorenstein Center was founded in 1986 as a memorial to Joan Shorenstein, a truly remarkable television journalist who died of breast cancer after a distinguished career. Her father, Walter Shorenstein, endowed the center as a place for a focused search of the intersection of the press, politics, and public policy. Walter Shorenstein not only made the center possible, but he has remained vitally interested in what we do and has been our unstinting supporter and friend. As David said, he could not be with us tonight, but his daughter and Joan's sister, Carol, is with us, and I ask you to join me in recognizing the Shorenstein family's great and ongoing support. A bit later, you will hear from our Theodore White lecturer for 2009, Taylor Branch. But first, I have another task to perform, which is an honor, but always a rather bittersweet one. In 2005, we at the Shorenstein Center lost a great and much admired friend, David Nyan, when he died unexpectedly. Some of you did not know David, and I want to speak of him briefly as we this year bestow the 5th annual David Nyan Prize for Political Journalism. David Nyan was a man of many parts, a devoted family man, beloved friend, and the best company in the world. He was a real Boston guy, big, handsome man with a mischievous smile, sparkly eyes, and the rare power to raise everyone's spirits and make it seem like a party was starting just by walking into the room. I saw him do it again and again during his time as a fellow at the Shorenstein Center. But tonight we honor David Nyan, the consummate reporter and political journalist, which is the role that occupied much of his life and at which he could not be bested. David was a reporter and then a columnist at the Boston Globe, and his work had both a theme and a character. The theme was almost always power, political power, and also especially the abuse of political power by the big shots at the expense of the little guy. He loved politics, but he also loved politicians. As a group, he respected them. He felt they were often given a raw deal and judged by a standard that was smug and sanctimonious, two things David never was. But if politics was the theme of David's work, the character of that work was a mixture of courage and righteous anger, leavened by a great sense of humor and the ability to write with both charm and passion. He relished a fight with a political figure or perspective, yet had a knack of seeing beyond the surface of issues and the baloney to the heart of things, and especially to the reality of what was going on. He was a self-avowed liberal and not defensive about it. As a columnist at the Globe, he was a battler, a no-holds-barred advocate. But he also was surprising to his readers because his take was always, most of all, David's. He was his own man, and he called them as he saw them. In his memory and honor, the Nyan family and many friends and admirers of David Nyan have endowed the David Nyan Prize for Political Journalism to recognize the kind of gutsy, stylish, and relentless journalism that David Nyan embodied. David's wife, Olivia, could not be with us tonight, but his daughters, Veronica and Kate, are here, I think, as are some members of the Nyan family. And I would like to ask them all to please stand. This year, the David Nyan Prize for Political Journalism goes to Nat Hentoff, a columnist and wordsmith of the highest order and without question supremely in the tradition of David Nyan, the one he set by being his own man and calling them as his brain and his heart sees them. The thing about Nat Hentoff that David Nyan would have liked best is his absolute determination to speak his mind. And it doesn't hurt that Nat, like David, speaks with a Boston accent. Nat is 84, and as you can see, he is unable to be with us tonight in the flesh, but we have him via satellite from New York. Nat Hentoff was born in Boston and grew up in Roxbury, went to Boston Latin School and Northeastern and did graduate work at Harvard and studied at the Sorbonne on a Fulbright Fellowship. But his passion wasn't journalism in those days of the early 1950s. It was jazz. Each year, the Nyan Prize is chosen by a distinguished group of judges that included, until his tragic passing a month ago, Jack Nelson, the legendary reporter of the Los Angeles Times. The judging group also includes Marty Nolan, another legendary journalist who grew up in Roxbury with Nat Hentoff. Marty knew that I was going to be doing this introduction tonight, and he wrote me, "Imagine a combination of James Madison, Duke Ellington, Henry David Thoreau, I.F. Stone, Dizzy Gillespie, and a bunch of others. Imagine them all as one teenager on a Blue Hill Avenue streetcar heading toward Boston Latin School." That's Nat Hentoff. Madison, Izzy Stone, and Duke Ellington in one man. That is indeed Nat Hentoff. He's published many books on jazz, such as Listen to the Stories, Nat Hentoff on Jazz and Country Music. But listen to the titles of some of his other books. Does Anybody Give a Damn? Nat Hentoff on Education. Our Children Are Dying. A Doctor Among Addicts. The First Freedom, The Tumultuous History of Free Speech in America. Free Speech for Me and Not for Thee, How the American Left and Right Relentlessly Censor Each Other. That last title is very Nat Hentoff because he declines to follow any party line. I used to read his weekly column in the Village Voice with a kind of fascination as he thundered for free speech and civil rights and much of what might also be just basically be considered the liberal agenda, while he also thundered against abortion. He was no one's man, and he never has been. His political writing has appeared in the New York Times, the New Yorker, where he was a staff writer for 25 years, and many other publications. He also writes on music, especially jazz, not surprisingly, for the Wall Street Journal. I shall give the final word to Marty Nolan. He fell in love with jazz and became its champion, its translator, and its troubadour. He fell for the First Amendment with a ferocity that sometimes astonishes the politically correct who might want to censor others. For Nat Hentoff, this is a homecoming to Boston, a city that he never really left because he took its heritage with him, like another Latin school product, William Lloyd Garrison, who became a fiery abolitionist newspaper man. It was Garrison who said, "I am in earnest. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will not retreat a single inch, and I will be heard." That's Nat Hentoff, our 2009 Nyan Prize winner, Nat Hentoff.
Duke Ellington used to say, "It don't mean a thing if it got that swing." And I'm going to try very hard to live up to a little of that. And maybe it helps that I went to the William Lloyd Garrison Elementary School in Roxbury. I wish I were there, but there are certain unwanted dividends of age. But for me, the best dividend is survival as a working reporter at 84. I've never had so many deadlines, and I'm working on two books. David Nyan, whom I much admired, and I am singularly honored by this prize in his name, he wrote in his final column for the Boston Globe, "You never worked just for the ownership, you wrote for your readers and yourself." Me too. And I also write, in my head anyway, for my mentors, principally, and he's just been named, Izzy Stone. Izzy told me early on, "If you're in this to change the world, get another job, but get the story." Izzy's reporting did make change because, as David Carr recently wrote in the New York Times, he carried significant sting because he used the music of fact, not cant. And Tom Wicker said of Izzy, "He never lost his sense of rage. Neither have I." I last saw my other main mentor, George Seldes, when he was well into the 90s. It was in the morning in his hotel room. He was doing what I do every morning, tearing leads for further stories out of newspapers, not out of the internet. Without even a good morning, he handed me some of those clips, urgently instructing me, "You ought to look into these." Long before we met, I found my calling, as I later realized, reading George Seldes' four-page newsletter, In Fact, the subtitle, An Antidote to the Falsehoods in the Daily Press. I saw stories there I'd seen nowhere else, like the lethal link between cigarettes and cancer, not covered then by the New York Times or any other leading paper. Ask for what we do now in this craft of journalism. We are in what Bix Beiderbecke titled his song, In a Mist. I recommend Alex Jones's Losing the News book because he shows we are not foredoomed to do that. But what I tell journalism students who ask me what their future may be is what one of the best and brightest of all us reporters, David Halberstam, told journalism students at the University of California, Berkeley, just before his fatal car crash. "This," he said, "is your chance to be paid to learn every day, going out every day and asking questions," unquote. Jazz, my other passion, has been called the sound of surprise. As a reporter, I find that a good deal, digging into stories, I find out a good deal of what I expected to find turns out sometimes to be surprisingly different and therefore more accurate. No matter what the future is of what we do, print, digital, or who knows these days, even extraterrestrial, I hope that those joining us now and into the years ahead will be continually energized by what I consider Louis Brandeis's subhead for journalism: sunlight is the best disinfectant. I also hope the new practitioners of journalism will feel, as I do every day, the excitement of the unexpected. Also, that they'll experience, as David Nyan wrote as he was leaving, that they'll experience the continuing dividend of, quote, fascinating folk, rascals and rogues, as well as heroes, unquote. For me, how else would I have gotten to meet and even hang out with Malcolm X, John Cardinal O'Connor, Dr. Kenneth Clark, Duke Ellington, Bayard Rustin, organizer of the 1963 March on Washington? Bayard never lost his zest for being, in Duke Ellington's phrase, beyond category. So were those others I mentioned. Getting to know and sometimes expose Dickensian figures in the public square and not in the public square, as well as in legal black holes, resulted in Izzy Stone, who was frequently out of step and isolated by his colleagues and almost everybody else. Izzy told me, "I have so much fun," he said, "doing this, I ought to be arrested." One last thing. I dedicated my first book long ago, The First Freedom, The Tumultuous History of Free Speech in America, to the newest generation of students through the years. All the years since, reporting on schools around the country, I found, and I still find, that most of the few students acutely aware of the First Amendment are in the student press, which was briefly brought into the First Amendment by the Supreme Court's glorious 1959 Tinker decision. Quote, "Neither teachers nor students shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate," unquote. But increasingly, the High Court, despite the fury of Justice William Brennan, whom I also got to know, the High Court has weakened that decision through prior restraints and other gag rules from school principals and boards of education. The American Civil Liberties Union and the Student Press Law Center helped these free press defendants in court, but adult reporters and assignment editors are largely indifferent. We need to join these battles for the future, not only the future of the press. As Mr. Jefferson warned, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. This is all the more true now as President Barack Obama continues the Bush-Cheney assaults on the Constitution, sometimes even going beyond them. Thank you.
I think you will agree that you have heard the authentic Nat Hentoff. Thank you, Nat.
Thank you.
Theodore H. White was also a consummate reporter with a passion for politics. He came to Harvard on a newsboy scholarship and went on to a very distinguished career as a journalist and also a historian. Indeed, Teddy White, as he was universally known, changed both political journalism and politics when he wrote The Making of the President 1960 about the Kennedy-Nixon campaign. For the first time, he raised the curtain on the warts and all side of presidential campaigns and changed forever the level of candor about the decision-making and the human drama that is now at the heart of campaign coverage. He followed that first book with three more Making of the President books in 64, 68, and 72. No doubt the Making of the President 2008 will not be a book, but an industry. Dan Baltz, one of our seminar speakers tomorrow, who is here tonight, has written one of the very best with Haynes Johnson. It's called The Battle for America 2008. Yet Teddy White's books stand as smart and groundbreaking examinations of what happens and why in the maelstrom of political campaigning. And it is fair to say, I think, that Teddy White's heirs are the journalists of today who try to pierce the veil of politics, to understand what is happening, and to then analyze and deliver the goods to those of us who are trying to understand. Before his death in 1986, Teddy White was one of the architects of what became the Shorenstein Center. One of the first moves Marvin Kalb, the center's founding director, was to raise the funds and establish the Theodore H. White Lecture. This year, the White Lecturer is to be delivered by Taylor Branch. Taylor Branch came of age in a way and in a place that Southerners like me understand very personally. He grew up in Atlanta in the 1950s, in a segregated world that may have looked benign in Driving Miss Daisy, but was not. It was a world of colored-only water fountains and separate entrances to movie theaters and lunch counters where black people were forbidden to sit and have a cup of coffee. It was the world that spawned Lester Maddox, who became governor of the state of Georgia using an axe handle as his symbol of implacable, violent resistance to African Americans who would presume to demand equal rights. It was also the town of a spellbinding preacher named Martin Luther King, Jr., who had a dream that transformed this nation. For Southerners of Taylor Branch's generation, which is my own, the civil rights movement was the crucible that pretty much put you on one side or the other politically. He found himself on the civil rights side, and after graduating from the University of North Carolina and getting a master's in public administration at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, he found himself sucked into journalism, a natural path that others like him had taken. In his case, he started at the top journalistically. He went to work for Charlie Peters, the much beloved and genuinely legendary founder of the Washington Monthly. The signature of the Washington Monthly was that it not only did groundbreaking political journalism, but that it expected its journalists to think as well as report and write. Dan Okrent, who has known Taylor Branch from those days, recalls that his copy arrived in sentences and paragraphs, finished, polished. I do think you need to take into consideration that Dan Okrent and Taylor got to know each other as poker-playing buddies and guys who, with Charlie Peters, adjourned to Saratoga for a week in the summer to go to the races. Just as Ray Charles famously did only one take when recording his songs, Taylor Branch seemed usually to do one draft, the first. With Charlie Peters, he wrote his first book, Blowing the Whistle, Dissent in the Public Interest, in 1972. He went on to become Washington editor for Harper's and then became a Washington columnist for Esquire. And he had interests beyond politics. One of his best books is Second Wind, written with Bill Russell. It is considered by the Cognoscenti to be one of the best books on basketball ever written. But his real destiny was something else. In the 1980s, he set out on a journey to write the definitive account of the life of America and civil rights through the prism of the life of Martin Luther King. The first volume was Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 1954 to 1963. And it won a Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award for General Nonfiction. This renowned book won the respect and admiration of those who had been skeptical that a white man, a white Southerner, could do a credible job on this complex, sensitive subject. His first volume made it clear that he was going to produce a masterpiece. The second volume, 10 years later, was Pillar of Fire, America in the King Years, 1963 to 1965. That was followed by a MacArthur Genius Grant and the National Humanities Medal. Then in 2006, 8 years after Volume 2, came the final volume, At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 1965 to 1968. The entire series totaled nearly 3,000 pages of historical rigor, tethered to the craft of a journalist who can interview and dig and report. And needless to say, he can write. More recently, he gave us the most candid and clear-eyed look into the presidency of Bill Clinton we are apt to get in the Clinton tapes, Wrestling History with the President. It is an up-close, behind-the-scenes account of the Clinton presidency gleaned from interviews in the White House with the president while his presidency was unfolding and unraveling. Between 1993 and 2001, Taylor Branch visited Bill Clinton 79 times in the White House to tape a sort of secret diary. Clinton had gotten to know Taylor Branch from their shared involvement in the McGovern campaign and reached out to him to be his Arthur Schlesinger, an in-house historian. Teddy White would have been deeply envious. Late at night, as he was driving home to Baltimore after his sessions with the president, Taylor Branch would record his recollections of what Clinton had said, along with his own thoughts and impressions. It is these ruminations that make up the core of the Clinton tapes, which President Clinton urged him to write. Our Theodore White lecturer this year is an historian, a journalist's journalist, and a man who took up the burden of telling the story of perhaps the most important national issue of his time, and then to become confessor to a president. We could not have made a better choice. Our Theodore White lecturer for 2009, Taylor Branch.
Thank you, Alex. I'm very happy to be here. I'm happy to be giving a lecture in the name of Teddy White, whom I only met a few times, but I studied a lot, and to be under Nat Hentoff, I wish I could be back up there. He kind of kicked us in the shins on the way out. I'm going to kick us in the shins on the way in to say that my title, Disjointed History, Modern Politics in the Media, is really an introduction to, I hope, grapple with serious problems that we may be sleepwalking in our era in journalism through the prelude to the equivalent of the Weimar Republic, if the state of the country is as bad as it seemed to me traveling around on book tour for this last month. The Clinton tapes has just come out, was something I worked on secretly while I was finishing America in the King Years. And it, in many respects, put me on a different planet from most of the public discourse that we have shared through our journalism. To put it bluntly, the question I want to pose to you tonight is, to what degree has poor performance contributed to the slow evaporation of mainstream journalism in our era? My Clinton project, recording late at night with the president, put me in a different world watching this and listening to what the president was saying, and it was secret. We managed to keep a secret for 8 years. In the interest of public disclosure later, we had to be quiet and secret. But it began and ended in profound disillusionment over the performance of modern journalism. This was a hard lesson for both of us. When I got to the University of North Carolina in 1964, newly converted against my will to an interest in politics from a pre-med plan and a love of football and girls and nothing else. The very first course I took was in political philosophy, captivated by the civil rights movement and beginning to worry about Vietnam. And on the first day of the political philosophy course, the professor astonished me by saying that if we wanted to solve problems of truth and justice in the world through philosophy, we had to begin by reading the New York Times every day. In Chapel Hill, North Carolina, for me, a Georgia boy, this was shocking. I had barely heard of the Times, but this professor had enormous influence over me, and I did, and I've read the New York Times to this day. And developed an idolization of the paper in part because of the performance of its civil rights reporters in the heyday of modern journalism, of Claude Sitton and John Herbers and Gene Roberts, who were risking their lives to cover the Freedom Rides and Birmingham and Selma. President Clinton did too. Even Hillary was converted from her Goldwater Girl background by the performance of the civil rights era. And she loved the New York Times for its performance and its contribution in that era. We had an apartment together in Austin, Texas for the McGovern campaign. We were 25 years old. People have asked me since, did I recognize that Bill Clinton was likely to be a future president? And I say, are you kidding? We lost Texas by 30 points. We didn't think either one of us was qualified to be dog catcher. And indeed, by the end of that campaign, we parted for 20 years. I didn't see him for 20 years in a pregnant disagreement. I told him that I couldn't understand why he was going to go run for Congress like the Energizer Bunny. This era didn't seem to faze him whatsoever. Hillary and I were both much more disillusioned, like our generation, that here, in the midst of this great war raging and the promise of the civil rights movement perhaps disintegrating in riots and disagreement and polarization, that in the midst of this, through this campaign, we spent most of our time refereeing the pettiest of disputes among Texas politicians over who sat where in the motorcade, who rode where, and who sat where on the dais. President Clinton, Bill Clinton at the time, told me, and I remembered this later, and he remembered the exact words. He said, Taylor, if you want to solve problems in the world, possibly even the Vietnam War, you've got to build up your tolerance and capacity for squabbles over who rides where in the motorcade. Because that's where things start. And you've got to go through human nature rather than disentangle and sit above it like you writers, which I thought was uncalled for at the time. But essentially what he was saying is that writers retreat behind a pose of just imagining themselves away from the inconvenient stubbornness of human nature, and that politicians can't afford to do that. I thought it was just his ambition talking, and I went into journalism, saying I thought there was more integrity there and that I couldn't take the pettiness of politics anymore. And that launched my career, and it launched me on a separate trajectory so that I didn't see him for 20 years until he initiated this notion of having said, I can't tape my phone conversations. I want to do the next best thing. Let's have a diary. Let's leave it all there. If we can keep it secret, I'll be candid and we'll tell this story. And the very first story told me, shocked me, saying, Taylor, I have been stampeded by the press and trampled entering the White House in 1993, and when he was leaving in 2001, he said, I was trampled by another stampede on the way out the door. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, let's take gays in the military. Gays in the military dominated the first 6 months of my presidency. It was not my idea. It was on the front page of the New York Times on the first morning I woke up in the White House, January 21st, 1993. Photograph of him delivering the inaugural address. Next to it, page one, column one, top headline, Clinton Initiative, Gays and Lesbians in Military Service. He said, it's pretty obvious when you look back on it that that was not the result of deliberations by my administration. We were out at the inaugural balls while those presses were rolling. We hadn't even found where the offices were or how the telephones worked, and we had spent the whole transition working on what we had run on in the election, the economy, all these economic forums down in Little Rock, our stimulus package, getting out of the recession. That's what we had run on, that's what we were going to do. But we woke up on the first morning, and this is the story that seized and stampeded the first 6 months. I said, well, Mr. President, couldn't you just hold a press conference and say, wait a minute, we'll get around to that, but that's not our, we haven't even chosen our first priority yet, we'll do it later. He says, Taylor, that's why you write politics, and I do the politics. If I had done that, the next day's story would be Clinton repudiates plan. He's run over by his generals and in revolt. Gays and lesbians are furious, and the administration is in disarray from the start. He said, in retrospect, that's not much worse than what happened. I said, how did this thing happen? He said, the only way he could figure it was that a reporter went to one of his young aides during the inaugural parade and said, did the president mean all 468 or whatever it was campaign promises? Yes. Does that include the promise to integrate gays and lesbians in military service? Yes. Is he serious about this? Yes. Therefore, headline. No reporter on any other newspaper suspected, so far as I'm aware, that this was a press fiat rather than any sort of deliberation by the administration, an administration that hadn't even entered office or done anything like it. But of course, then he and I get to go through the results of having gays and lesbians in the military, the most inflammatory inheritance from the 1960s among his campaign pledges, be the opening vignette in the presidency of the first baby boomer from the 1960s. So we had amazing stories of Senator Robert Byrd coming in 5 days, the president's been there in the Oval Office delivering a long and learned lecture to other senators about the Roman historian Suetonius and how he wrote that Julius Caesar had had an affair with the king from Turkey and set every wag in the Roman Empire saying that Julius Caesar was every woman's man and every man's woman, planting the seeds of homosexuality that destroyed the world's greatest military empire, and this senator will not stand for that here with gays in the military. And then the other senators jumped in and started saying, well, Senator, that's very interesting about the Roman Empire, but those Roman emperors seem to ravish people of every sex and win wars for centuries. I don't know that you get that out of there. And as for the Bible, anti-homosexual rules didn't make the Ten Commandments, whereas lying and adultery did, and we all know plenty of lying, philandering who make pretty good soldiers. And it went back and forth, and he finally said, I looked over at Teddy Kennedy, and I didn't know whether he was going to start giggling or jump out the window watching this debate on a brand new president on an issue that dominated the first 6 months of his presidency. Then, of course, came Whitewater. From the New York Times story, nobody to this day can put what Whitewater was in one sentence, whatever it was, but it lasted for the entire 8 years of his presidency and morphed into Filegate and Travelgate and accusations that he had murdered his best friend who committed suicide. And he said that Hillary was the last holdout against his request to have a Whitewater special prosecutor, saying this, from her work on the Nixon impeachment committee, would destabilize the whole balance of powers, that the special prosecutor would be unaccountable to anyone, that the president would, as long as the special prosecutor was there, not be able to superintend the executive branch of the government, because any effort that he took in that regard would be seen as self-interested, and it would undermine not only the supervision of the FBI and the Justice Department, but the other executive branches as well. And all over allegations that predated the presidency and therefore did not belong, could not belong with the only legitimate purpose of presidential investigations, which is an investigation of presidential powers. Therefore, it is wrong. You shouldn't do it, Bill. And he said the whole country was in an uproar. What can I do? What do you have to hide? This is the only way to answer these questions. If you just submitted all the answers more candidly, this would already be over. And he said, that's what they said in the New York Times. I admired the New York Times. I believed them. Hillary was right. I was stupid. The biggest mistake of my career. Then shortly after that, we run into another one. Waco and Atlanta and Oklahoma City, the Oklahoma City bombing. We had a session on the night of the Oklahoma City bombing. Chelsea came in while we were talking to say that she was writing a homework assignment on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and its conception of evil. And we're sitting there dealing with the reports of how many people are dead in Oklahoma City and whether it's a foreign terrorist or not. And the president said the most surreal thing out of that, from the standpoint of somebody interested in the press, was that after Timothy McVeigh, a corn-fed Iowan, turned out to be the one who set this bomb, killing Social Security workers and their children in nurseries, worst act of terrorism to date in America, that the House and the Senate held hearings not on excesses of government hatred, but they held more hearings on Waco, which was his motivation for blowing up. He said, this is Alice in Wonderland. We have a prime example of anti-government hatred turning into terrorism in this country, and all of the hearings are about Waco as though this were justified somehow. Not one hearing into the motivation of Timothy McVeigh, who was executed without very much understanding whatsoever of his crime. Now, the president was angry in the first term, more than I would like to admit. I kept telling him, I don't think you need to do this. All presidents fuss about their press coverage, but you're doing it a lot. And when he did it, though, he would never be angry very long without starting to figure out why. Bill Clinton is a puzzle solver. He was trying to figure it out. Why? He said, first of all, he said, there was a perfect storm from the 1960s, which is why I seem to be bedeviled by it. In the 1960s, when it became unfashionable for conservatives and George Wallace to defend segregation, he invented language to attack the government that was promoting integration, to attack pointy-headed bureaucrats and tax and spend liberals. And he made government itself an object of scorn. He said at the same time, liberals came apart over the fact that it took so long for the government to respond to civil rights and that liberals made the Vietnam War. So that liberal became a dirty word among people on the left before even on the right. And it's virtually become extinct, and our whole political debate has collapsed behind the notion that government is a malevolent force, which is not historical, and it's certainly not patriotic. So he tried out that idea. Then he came up with the idea. He said, Taylor, you know, when we first came to Washington, you would go out and on Connecticut Avenue and you would see reporters with their bag lunches, eating with their sack lunches, sitting out or going to Scholl's cafeteria for $3.50 lunch. Now they have $200 martini lunches. Maybe the problem is that they don't care anymore about the politics that matters to ordinary Americans, about welfare reform, about the earned income tax credit, about the things that we're doing. But there's something wrong with the press that they don't deal with right issues. Then he said, maybe it's the end of the Cold War. For 50 years, we had this great balance of world threat that gave substance to journalism and why we care about all of these issues. Then it evaporated in 1989. There's no longer any hook that makes these matters serious, and it allows us to have politics just for entertainment, and we've slipped into that. Finally, he said, in 1994, in some of these talks, he said, there's fragmentation in their markets, and maybe these people don't have any chance. They don't have any choice except to be more tabloid to try to keep up with their competition as their markets fragment. Then by the second term, he's saying, I hope with re-election that maybe some of this silliness and tabloid distraction from the issues that matter to the American people will diminish with my re-election. But then Whitewater kept going, and not only that, it turned into a new scandal, also started by the New York Times, called Chinagate. The suspicion and the charge that President Clinton had sold nuclear secrets to China for campaign contributions. And not to mention Al Gore in the Buddhist temple praying and the charges that they were selling the Lincoln bedroom and so on and so forth. And it went through the whole second term, all the way down to a nuclear scientist, Wen Ho Lee, serving a year in solitary out in California, out of Los Alamos, on allegations that utterly collapsed by the time that Clinton left office. But it collapsed too late to help him. But these were amazing headlines. President ignores evidence of nuclear spying. Virtually whole nuclear arsenal compromised. These are serious things. They went on for 4 years. And then, of course, finally he said he was kicked on the way out the door by a hook, line, and sinker scandal that his people had removed all of the W's off the computers and had vandalized the White House on the way out the door, and that he had pardoned Mark Rich, and that he was a Bubba, no good son of a bitch on the way out the door, which foreclosed any objective or empirical evaluation of the long-term trends of the Clinton presidency, some things that look pretty good now. 4.2% unemployment, 20 million new jobs, a balance between military and political objectives in all the wars, almost zero casualties, peace efforts on four continents, and paid down $600 billion in the national debt with surpluses in the last 18 months on a course to pay off the entire historical national debt of the United States by next year, 2010. We're a long way from that now. Attitude can trump fact. It's not new in American politics. I grew up believing and being taught that the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery, and that all of America was thankful to the Ku Klux Klan for rescuing us from the evils of Reconstruction, which allowed this country to ignore the 13th Amendment guaranteeing the right to vote for a century. These things happen. But in our time, we have had an imbalance in journalism over things that matter that is hard to explain. I do not say that poor performance and entertainment and spitball journalism, or as I put it, high school journalism, to make all of journalism about who's cool and who's not cool and that sort of thing, is the sole cause for the trivialization of our public debate. Sad as it is that so much of it is two sides saying that the world would be perfect if the other side just dropped dead, with no thought really on either side, that our modern journalism has allowed this to be the public debate is a great tragedy. I don't think that it's only poor performance that's done it. There are enormous structural, economic, technological challenges that are hurting the form of journalism today, but not the content. And what I am saying is that poor performance has made the decline far less glorious than it should have been if more people were standing up for asking the hard questions that a citizenship journalism, as opposed to a consumer-based, let's have fun journalism, would promulgate. There's always fun in politics. There's always entertainment. There are always good stories and room for I.F. Stone. But democracy is hard. There was a reason that it didn't exist for 2,000 years. Our founders understood that you got to think hard and ask questions all the time in order for it to prosper. And the first journalism was citizens looking for a market rather than a market trying to figure out if it could afford citizenship. And if we're going to rescue modern journalism, it's going to need more thought, and it's going to need more contribution from universities outside of journalism to recognize that these civic ideas are hard, that even on something as silly as executive pay, that there's more to the debate than a desire to have a pay czar to take their money away versus leave it alone and have a free market, that these are issues of governance and people ought to be thinking about how to remake the system so that these things cannot prevail as an issue of corporate governance, political governance, and the way our system works. We need thought, we need better journalism, and I submit from the experience of the Clinton tapes, which is admittedly eccentric, done mostly in secret, and just sprung on the world in the last week, that we have serious problems about our perspective on what matters and what does not matter in modern journalism as well as modern politics. Thank you.
We have time for some questions, and I would ask those of you with questions to please go to the microphone here, there, and there are two up here. And I would invite you to, you know, address a question to Taylor based on what he has said. And also, if you have parenthetical kinds of thoughts, we'd like to hear them too. I'd like to ask the first one. You, in this litany that you gave about Bill Clinton's tenure, you did not mention the words Monica Lewinsky. I wondered why.
I can't imagine that there's new information that people need about Monica Lewinsky that I could bring to this forum here, although I do write about it in the book. He mentions it, and it's obviously. What I will say, he said on Lewinsky that put in the book, I mean, he said a lot, but I mean, the part that was most pregnant to me is that he said his mission, he saw his mission, because to him, politics from the 1960s ought to, by any objective account, have ennobled our sense of what politics can do. That on balance, it did amazing things. It lifted freedom not only for black people in ending segregation, removing terrorism, but also for women and for white Southerners and all, that it should have enhanced our view of what politics can do, and instead it spawned this era of government is bad. And his mission was to lift the veil through performance of cynicism that he thought was distorting our public discourse. And he was fighting against and against the scandal mongering and the tabloid stuff. And he said, I might have had a chance, but I lost it all through Monica Lewinsky because that allowed, I gave my enemies a sword. It allowed them to say, see there, he's corrupt and politics is no good. And to evade all of the rest of the stuff that I mentioned. Now, I mentioned it to you overly provocatively from his point of view, but certainly from the point of view of balance, Monica Lewinsky is significant in the sense that he forfeited the effort to get people to have a better balanced appreciation of what does and doesn't matter to the great mass of voters.
John.
Taylor, you mentioned at the outset that you were on a book tour and you encountered all kinds of public opinions. Can you sort of give us a feeling, how does the public, is there any consensus? Are we on the verge of 1789 in France? What's going on as you see it? Maybe it varies greatly geographically, but is there any consensus? Is there anything but cynicism in the people that you've just been seeing for the last few weeks?
That's a good question. I've been on a book tour for a month. This book just came out. And what I've seen more than anything is fear from people in bookstores and that sort of thing. Anxiety. Fear may be too strong a word, but really strong anxiety that they don't understand what's happening. On the Clinton tapes themselves, so that's in general as citizens, but in response to the Clinton tapes, which is a strange book. I mean, it's kind of on my shoulder going into the White House, hearing the president vent and tell stories and everything else. What they've reacted to more than anything are the personal parts about him and Hillary and Chelsea growing up and that sort of thing. Hillary came in one night while we were having a session and said she'd just had a dream about Henry Kissinger and could I help her interpret it? People love that stuff. And I think that in a way it's like a refuge from all of these really tough issues, because if he's right that our public discourse needs to be rehabilitated in the face of all of these problems that they think may be swamping the economy, then that's a really daunting task, and they'd rather read about Chelsea's correspondence with Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and you know, some of the stuff that's much more personal.
Good evening. Based on your in-depth knowledge of King and the civil rights movement and the aspirations of that movement, what do you think the people of that time, and King in particular, would think of Barack Obama's election and his performance thus far?
Well,
very easy question.
I always hesitate to speak for Martin Luther King. He's actually been dead longer than he was alive. It's a long time. I think he would have certainly. This was not something anywhere near on the radar or the horizon of possibility in 1968. Look at Harvard in 1968 as compared to now. I don't even think there were any female students or at Yale, and very, very few minorities. And now it's one of the most amazingly diverse places on Earth. King's refrain always was, we've come a shockingly long way on the promise of democracy, but we still have a long way to go. I think even with Barack Obama, which is a stupefying and unexpected foothold on freedom, we still have a long way to go. And objectively speaking, we have all of these forces of disintegration that are every bit as powerful as the forces of optimism and hope. So I think he would feel menaced. In balance, in the past, now when I was working on King, which was all during this, remember, when I'm doing the diary for Bill Clinton, I'm working every day on Martin Luther King. My mind is back in the 1960s, and once a month or every 3 weeks, I'd get yanked down there to ask him these questions late at night, and then I would go back. But when I was doing it, the big thing to me, the impression that I gathered over the time of working, was that I think Martin Luther King would be more impressed on balance, and this is before Barack Obama, with things that have happened outside the United States than inside the United States as far as the witness of the freedom movement. Nonviolence, which has more or less been eclipsed. There are very few people who speak up for nonviolence, even though you can make a very good argument that it was the most powerful idea to come out of that era and had the greatest influence. Nonviolence has had a much greater career outside the United States since. I don't know how much it's discussed even here at Harvard, but it was in South Africa, and it was in Gdansk for the Polish ship workers, and it was when the Berlin Wall came down and the Velvet Revolution. It was in Tiananmen Square, which didn't win but is not forgotten. Those are modeled on sit-ins. And so in many respects, nonviolence and the witness of the King civil rights movement has gone out into the world, which is great. And in an ironic way, I think its antecedents and its underpinnings are less appreciated in its home than they are anywhere else.
Hi, I'm Julia Ryan. I'm a freshman at Harvard College. My question, I sympathize greatly with your disappointment in journalism today, but I'm wondering, where can one go to find good reporting? Where can one educate themselves about politics in a way that is unbiased and clear?
Well, there's lots of good reporting going on today, including in the New York Times. It's just got a lot of silliness in there, like a page one story over whether Barack Obama plays basketball with too many men. Why that's on the front page is real. So there's a lot of good reporting. What I'm saying is that I think the lesson is that citizens are going to have to take far greater responsibility in the future for finding things that actually educate rather than pander to them, and that are good information in the sense that our validators and our filters are no longer as reliable, and they may not be around. They may literally not be there. And if that's true, then we are in for an amazing time of reconstituting the best values of journalism, which will be out there. There'll be people practicing them. They'll just be harder to find. So it's going to put a greater burden on every citizen to educate himself or herself through diverse means, rather than simply listening to Walter Cronkite every night and reading the New York Times.
Hi, I'm Marcy Murnihan. I'm with the Corporate Social Responsibility Initiative here at the Kennedy School. We heard Nat Hentoff speak earlier to the fact of the failure of journalism to establish a link between cigarettes and cancer. And your statements seem to be about the abuse of power, that issues like CEO pay are really more than just pay. It's about governance. It's about the disjointed dislocation of power, which is a cancer on the body politic. I wonder what you might have to say about another area, I think a sleeper issue that is not getting a lot of attention, and that is the role of the gambling industry with respect to its infiltration of state legislatures, state by state, and its predatory practices with respect to threatening, again, sort of the free will of the people and its relatively addictive tendencies to do damage to the body politic.
Well, you've my friend Dan Okern here hired me.
I'm talking about horse racing.
Hired me to write an article for the New England Monthly 25 years ago on, because the modern era of lotteries, which was the beginning of state-sponsored gambling, started in New England, in rock-ribbed New England, New Hampshire of all places, as a way of avoiding taxes. And Danny asked me to do an article on the history of lotteries. And it is a remarkable. All you have to do is study it. You know, every lottery starts with a promise that we're going to have a drawing once every 2 months, and we're very cautious and everything. And 10 years later, they're doing lotto games and Keno every 5 minutes, and all of that inhibition is gone, and so on. Sooner or later, the public catches up to the fact that these odds are no good and they're being robbed, and so then they have to invent some even more ridiculous game to spike it and have a $1 billion winner or a $100 million winner or something like that. It is a life cycle of addiction, but to your point, what it rests on, state-sponsored gambling, rests at bottom on the citizens playing other citizens for suckers, which goes against the bedrock principle of what a compact of citizens is all about. And you can't escape that. And it takes root in an atmosphere of contempt for what government can and can't do. So the government is bad, which I would argue has been the dominant idea in national politics. Everybody's run against Washington since the 1968 election. Is the atmosphere, the corrosive atmosphere in which gambling can sell this notion that the state itself should promote gambling, preying on those people who go. And, you know, very few of the people that promote it play the games because they're too smart. So it is a sad thing, and it's very corrosive. In the 19th century, there is a history of this. There was the Louisiana Lottery, was the nationwide lottery. One of the great marketing campaigns of all time was that they got General Beauregard from the South, and General Howe, there was a big Northern general from the Civil War, and they both drew them together to get the Louisiana Lottery going. And it took 30 years to strangle the Louisiana lottery, which was called the serpent, and it was all over the country, and even in that era, they were trying to get rid of it. It's hard once it gets going. It has already, under our noses, seeped into every state, including, I was just at the Clinton Library, there's now a brand new, Arkansas was one of the last holdouts. There's now the new Arkansas Lottery, and they had posters for it, you know, buying lottery tickets outside the Clinton Library, which really stunned me.
Hi, Taylor.
Hey.
Andrew Friendly.
Hi.
The first part of my question is, at the beginning of the administration, when you talked about gays in the military...
Andrew, you should say who you are.
Oh, I'd spent a number of years with President Clinton as his aide, but...
That's where I met him, yeah.
At the beginning of the administration, when you talked about gays in the military, I'd argue a little bit about how the New York Times was the one promoting the story. Certainly, they ran the story first, but I have a feeling that it was probably the opposition party who planted that story and made sure that it was there to dislodge the president and the administration from the first step. But on a second issue, there's not not one person is the voice of any one newspaper. But I think the president's relationship with Hal Raines, or at least the view of that relationship with Hal Raines, certainly clouded his impression or his view of the New York Times as a whole. Maybe if you could talk a little bit about that, and maybe perhaps the conflict between two Southerners of the same generation, but that was certainly a driving force, I think, of his relationship with the paper.
Thank you, Andrew. He talked about Hal Raines a good bit, and that's in the book. But I think it went beyond that. He also talked about Maureen Dowd and Jeff Girth and lots of other people, who, by the way, so far as I know from my publisher, the only two people who have lodged formal complaints against the Clinton tapes saying that they were unfairly treated have been Jeff Girth and Maureen Dowd, who have world record nerve in my view. But yes, he did talk about Howell. That gave him another whole angle about Southerners and people trying to prove that they were the right kind of Southerner or whatever. That was very, very, very deep, and it went, but he mentioned that and lots of other things about the Times. It was painful for him. You know, but at the same time, if the Washington Post came out with a very critical series about his handling of Somalia in the Black Hawk Down thing, and he highlighted that, said it was very good journalism, it was really tough, because he said it was on the merits. It was the stuff that was extraneous and ad hominem that upset him, because it was not on the merits. And he complimented New York Times for good stories that were adverse too, but it was the trivial obsession that upset him the most. And you may be right that the gays in the military originated with political opposition, working with the reporter to try to get somebody on the record to say this was the first initiative. But it doesn't excuse, I mean, just think about it. The story that was their first choice of what to emphasize is false. And that shouldn't be surprising. It's obvious. They wouldn't start with that. Their whole thing was gearing toward they were totally ambushed by this thing. And so to present it as though the administration has decided to make it their first choice, and then we're all reacting to that and saying, oh, that was a terrible first choice, or they're not handling right, but we're all doing it on the playground established by that story. And the story was false. Whether or not it had collusion from political opposition.
Martin?
I want first to say how much I've enjoyed reading your stuff and listening to you tonight. My question goes back to Alex's first question to you. I don't think you answered his question.
About Monica Lewinsky?
Yeah, I don't think you answered it. He asked, why did you not talk about that? And my question, not Alex's, but a follow-up, is if you were back in your days as a reporter, how would you have handled the Lewinsky story? If you were an editor at the Times, would you have put it on the front page? Would you have had follow-up stories? Were you surprised by the way in which that caught fire in all of journalism? Help me out.
Well, the Lewinsky story is 5 years into the Clinton presidency. It's made possible by the fact that over those 5 years, the other scandals, Whitewater, on and on and on, up to and culminating in Paula Jones, had eroded our understanding of what a proper investigation of a president should be, to the point that a sitting president is compelled to answer questions about his sex life under oath without boundary. That is the serious thing about Monica Lewinsky. Once it happens that in the course of this deposition that a sitting president has to sit there on a case that predated his presidency and answer questions about his sex life, yes, once it comes out that the president under oath has, of course, she also swore that they didn't have this affair too. Under oath. So they both swore that it didn't happen, but it came out that he had sworn it didn't happen, and there were people who doubted it, and she was an intern, and then a huge uproar. I don't have terrible problem with how it was covered once it came out. I have a problem with how we got there in the first place. We totally degraded our sense of what a presidential investigation ought to be about. No, we got, because all of the erosion of what you're, remember, the blue dress is in 1997. It comes out in 1998. The whole first term was, before he met Monica Lewinsky, all of these scandals that established the notion that the president is under perpetual investigation on things that wander everywhere and degrade our sense of what a president is supposed to do. I'm giving you, that is his defense. Now, I did talk to him about Monica Lewinsky, but you're right, I did not talk to him about, you know, what color her thong was or any of that. I wasn't interested in that. I'm squeamish. And you know, my book is not a historical evaluation of Clinton. It's a record of gathering this primary record. And unlike journalists, it was not my, I did not see it as my job to wrestle his accountability to the ground, because this record was for 10 years from now. It wasn't, you know, an evaluation of his performance in the moment, which is what, you know, Evan Thomas says, you know, I should have gotten more information out about Monica Lewinsky. I talked about virtually every subject as he was comfortable about, but he's absolutely right. I didn't, with all that was going on in the world, and every time I went in there, you would see the world on his, you see why people age and all that business. To have made that a priority, and of course it would have been late anyway, because I didn't even know about Monica Lewinsky until when the story broke, 1998. And we talked about it. We talked about it during the impeachment trial, by which time Hillary was already his most, his fiercest defender on impeachment, which was hard for me to reconcile and understand. But no, I didn't push it that much. But I did agree with him that the significant erosion for people who are interested in public policy occurred before even he heard of Monica Lewinsky, let alone the rest of us.
Final question, Richard.
I'd like not to talk about Monica Lewinsky. I'd like to talk about the president's Russia policy, because it seems to have left in its wake so much damage in the countries of the former Soviet Union and Soviet Empire, in particular the distrust of the Russian people of America and a willingness on the part of Russia to attempt to play a great power role in areas of key American interest, whether Europe or Iran. But what was going on in Clinton's mind in allowing those policies to develop?
Well, I'm not sure I accept your premise, Richard, that it was within his power to have had a spawned a smooth transition to democracy within Russia. I think he worked on it a lot, or at least he said he did. Now, he may have failed. He certainly spent a lot of time. It was in the context of one of many discussions about the awesome task that faced Boris Yeltsin in the wake of the disintegration of the Soviet Empire, to create free institutions in an empire across 11 time zones, menaced by old communists and imperialists, nuclear weapons lying around everywhere, and the mafia, and infant institutions. And Clinton is trying to decommission the nuclear weapons, and he's trying to deal with Boris Yeltsin. He said he thought it was the most difficult geopolitical task for any national leader on the globe that he knew of at that time. And he said, let me tell you what happened just the other night. The Secret Service called me at 3 a.m. and said that Yeltsin had escaped Blair House in his underwear and was out in Pennsylvania Avenue, 3 sheets to the wind, trying to hail a taxi to go get a pizza. What do I do? And then he said the very next night he escaped again. He didn't get out of Blair House, but he eluded the Russian security guards and went down in the basement and was trying to sneak out the basement, again drunk, but dressed, and ran into an American EX Executive Security Service guard with the Russian agents coming behind him, and they had a confrontation of agents in the basement, not sure that it was Yeltsin. The point he was trying to make, he said, we're trying to work with Yeltsin to accomplish almost impossible things. Made more trips there than anywhere. He said in 1994, Hillary and I both have a bad feeling about what's going to happen in Russia just walking around. The authoritarianism is very strong there, the chaos, the fear of the mafia. You know, the first thing that the Russians asked for when he went to Moscow, they wanted Louis free. They wanted Louis Free to go and tour the Soviet Union because they saw him and J. Edgar Hoover as like a magic bullet that could inspire them to get rid of the mafia. That's what they wanted. They wanted Louis Free, and he explained why that was so. But when he was talking about Yeltsin, pardon? Well, his relations with Louis Free weren't very good, but I don't think he could send Louis Free anywhere. That's part of his problem. But he said that trying to do this with Russia made him realize that. He told me this story because he said the handicap in dealing with this is that Boris Yeltsin is not just your jolly Russian who likes his vodka. This is a hardcore alcoholic and who's lived a hard life. And every now and then, he said, and this wasn't then, this was much later, he said that that he would allow Yeltsin and talk to Yeltsin to denounce the United States because he had to for political reasons back home, and they would agree, I'll cut you up, and this, that, and the other. But he said his own advisors feared that Yeltsin was like Putin, what we see of as Putin. And he would say, I had to reassure myself every now and then, and I still believe it, that on balance we didn't have any choice but to work with him as hard as we can, and that somewhere underneath that I always felt the guy who climbed up on the tank. The guy who climbed up on the tank to forestall the coup that would have restored the authoritarian empire is still in there somewhere. He thought that. He's still in there somewhere, but he faces almost a superhuman task, and he's a hardcore raging alcoholic. So it's a pretty tough hand to be dealt.
Taylor Branch, thank you very, very much.